Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Glenn Krause here with Core CDI with another great podcast. We're going to be talking today with Michelle. Michelle Barrett. She's a registered nurse and an attorney as well as a CCDS. Great background, obviously. She has 9 years of extensive, in-depth CDI experience, including at a level one trauma center that was also the county indigent teaching hospital, and currently work at a large healthcare system writing appeals of clinical validation denials from all payers. She's been an attorney for over 30 years and an RN for 16 years. What a, as I mentioned, great background for CDI. And she has 2.5 years of bedside ICU experience. She's presented videos and webinars regarding insurance denials and appeals, and she's also spoken at 2 local access conferences and for her organization's multiple times. So she's well vested in CDI, and I think she has a very interesting perspective on CDI. So, Michelle, I'm glad to have you on the show and the podcast talking about clinical validation denials and what role does CDI play. So I want to start off by asking you a few questions and just can respond with your experiences. Like, you're deep down in the thick of clinical validation and also interspersed medical necessity denial. So what are your thoughts on why clinical validation and medical necessity denials are increasing?
Insurance companies' bottom line is to make money. And so to do that, the best way to do that is to not pay claims. And especially with the Medicare Advantage plans, people wonder how are they having all of these things for the same Medicare premium, but they add all these extra things. How do they do it and not go broke? Well, they don't pay their claims. So that's how. And the clinical validation denial is one of the tools that they use to not pay claims.
And the question I have is, do you think they change the rules as they go? Because you've seen some, obviously, denial letters. Do they make any clinical sense, or is there any rationale, or are they just picking and choosing as they can just to throw up roadblocks and not pay?
For the most part, they pick and choose and throw up roadblocks and not pay. Especially because you'll see that these are motivated by what is the lower weighted DRG. So sepsis is a diagnosis, for example, that they challenge all the time. But on that rare occasion when sepsis actually pays less than some other DRG that you have, all of a sudden they will say sepsis needs to be the principal diagnosis, and none of the things will be present that they have used to challenge sepsis in the past.
Oh, so they use the system to their advantage, in other words.
Absolutely.
And do they cite anything, do they cite clinical? Because obviously when a CDI professional queries for a particular diagnosis, whether it's a CC, excuse me, MCC or principal, principal diagnosis, we're looking for clinical indicators. So how do they circumvent the clinical indicators that we're using? It just behooves me how they can take a record that we issued a particular query, we've been beating our head that we need to use clinical indicators for our queries for additional diagnosis of specificity. So how do they punch holes through that?
So they do cite what they say are clinical authoritative sources,
yeah,
but they misquote or misstate what the source actually says. They cite sepsis too all the time, but then they still insist that there needs to be some evidence of a systemic response to infection that is remote from the tissues of infection. That, to me, is sepsis 3. The sepsis 2 article does not say that.
So what they really do is pick and choose. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yes, and they'll name a credible authoritative source, but they'll misstate what's contained therein or misquote it.
What about medical necessities and ours? What do you? I know the bulk of your work is clinical validation, but you, in the conversation recently, you said you also address medical necessity denials. What are you seeing there?
I do that very, very rarely, and I haven't done that in a while, so maybe I'm not the best to weigh in on that.
Well, I'm seeing, I think from my, certainly from my perspective, and this kind of leads us to the next concept or issue on a, excuse me, I'm fighting the cold, area we want to focus on is medical necessity denials. Okay, so insurance companies will say, you know, obviously when you get authorization for Medicare, Medicare Advantage plans, or any commercial payer, or Medicaid managed care, you get an authorization number, but it says the recording or the person, the nurse on the other end says, blah blah blah, there's no guarantee of payment, subject to review, and insurance verification at the time of billing. Okay, so oftentimes some of the big major insurers, no names mentioned, but we know who they are. They a year later, 6 months later, they want to review a case for medical necessity, and I think it's because a medical loss ratio, which is defined as how much premiums are taken in compared to how much is spent on actual patient care, for under the Accountable Care Affordable Care Act, it says that commercial payers can't have any lower than an 87% medical loss ratio. It means for every dollar of premium taken in, they have to spend 87 cents on direct patient or patient care. So, and after the fact, they'll take a chart and they'll pick it apart and say there was no medical necessity and then want to recoup your money. So I wanted to kind of go over, is CDI contributing to these denials by design? Do you feel that anything, our role as CDI specialists, and I'm certainly not putting our role down, of querying for physicians, reviewing cases, using our CDI software to prioritize cases with a quote-unquote greatest opportunity for improvement, meaning diagnosis, addition, or specificity, and leaving of queries and tracking our queries and so forth, is that contributing to the denials that you're seeing on the clinical validation back end?
To some extent it is, and one of the ways that it does contribute is when CDI does a query and the physician answers the query and
right.
adds that diagnosis,
uh-huh.
say by an addendum to a progress note, but that diagnosis doesn't carry forward to subsequent progress notes or the discharge summary, and that diagnosis is only in the medical record once at the time of discharge.
Right.
That can cause a problem, because then in the denial letter, they often cite that the diagnosis wasn't consistently documented throughout the hospital stay. So they want to deny the diagnosis for that reason.
Does it make it more challenging to appeal those claims?
It does. It does. And my recommendation to CDI is, if you see that situation, send one more query and for the purpose of asking if the diagnosis was ruled out at discharge, and if it was not, to please add it to the discharge summary.
Yeah, I think that's really important. The other thing I'm seeing, Michelle, in my reviews of charts that have been denied for medical necessity or clinical validation is that I think we're spending too much time on what I call drop, grab, and run. We drop a query, we come back to see whether it was answered, we grab the diagnosis and record the win, if you will, in our CDI software, then we run to the next case. And we're not necessarily doing a very proficient job at ensuring that the diagnosis is carried through. I think physicians think that once is enough, and the coding clinic doesn't speak to how many times a diagnosis has to be specifically charted. But we're I think adding fuel to the fire, because when we just diagnose it once, we think that's enough, and that's not really enough. What about this concern I have? I want to see if what your thoughts are. Is that we issue a clinic a valid compliant query, but unfortunately, the clinical picture that describes that diagnosis, not the lab results, not the treatment, not the workup per se, but the clinical story, the clinical information and facts is just not well executed. Are you seeing that in contributing to clinical validation denials?
Absolutely, and I've addressed this recently in multiple presentations. And what I say about this is that the physical exam, which in many times in today's modern electronic medical record,
right,
is a template, has to match the diagnosis. And we get into trouble when we pull in a normal physical exam template. There are other things in the documentation that describe the condition, so the query gets sent, but the physical exam doesn't match the query. For example, encephalopathy, where the physical exam says they're alert and oriented times three.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen that.
Or sepsis in the emergency room when the physical exam says they're well appearing and in no acute distress. If the physician in the emergency room is diagnosing the patient with sepsis, that's when they should absolutely look the sickest. And their physical exam should match that diagnosis. If it doesn't, there's a problem.
And so what do you think? And I've seen that. I had a case recently downgraded by one of the insurance companies, and the diagnosis was UTI, number one. Number two, excuse me, encephalopathy, acute encephalopathy. So this is how the H&P read from the assessment and plan. And this is what we focus on. This is what we focus on, obviously, matching the assessment with the plan. We look at the results, the workup, okay? Number one, severe UTI secondary to severe deep-seated UTI secondary to noncompliance with meds, okay? Patient was seen in urgent care, and they felt better. They stopped taking their antibiotics, okay? Well, it says on the bottle, please, take the entire entire course of antibiotics or drug, even if you're feeling better. Okay, so the patient didn't follow the directions. We got a Z code for noncompliance. Okay, then number two, acute encephalopathy secondary to number one. Okay, well, I like the fact that we had number one, and then they had a description why. Number two, due to, secondary to, associated with, this is great documentation. Okay, but when you look at the physical exam, alert and oriented times three, and no alert and oriented in all three quadrants, no complaints at this time. Well, how do you defend a case like that? And I'm wondering, do you think, Michelle, this CDI is just focusing on the clinical indicators and not looking at the clinical picture? I'm just wondering why we continue to see documentation like this. It's the same record that the CDI is looking at.
Yes, and I think that is correct. And I think that the templates that are existing in the electronic medical record are probably, while those were meant to help physicians, and to some extent they do us a disservice. And I think, too, with CDI, we tend to be focused on the diagnosis as opposed to painting the whole picture.
That's right.
Of the patient that the physician is seeing. And really, we need, in today's world, the medical record has to paint the whole picture. And there's another issue that I want to call your attention to that's very closely related to the other two that we've already talked about.
Uh-huh.
And that is, for example, you get into a teaching hospital and the physician calls it, the attending physician calls it encephalopathy.
Right.
And the resident calls it altered mental status, and the intern calls it delirium. So you have it called three different things, and that's another basis for denial, because it says that you know, how do we know it was encephalopathy when it wasn't consistently called that? It's not consistent in the medical record. You can't code it.
And
so
what,
everybody needs to be on the same terminology when they're describing a condition, too.
Very good point. Just one comment on that, or one question. Based on your 9 years of experience and your deeper experience with denials and so forth, and seeing what are the contributing factors, what role does CDI play, and how do they address the maybe inconsistencies in documentation? Is it best done through a query process? Is it best done through physician education? I'm wondering, what do you think?
Physician education. Definitely, physician education is the key. And when you're doing your physician education, make sure and mention to the interns and the residents to please look at the documentation by the attending physician, and to take that attending physician's lead. And if they're calling something using a certain diagnostic term to describe a condition, that the interns and the residents should consider using that same diagnostic terminology, because that attending physician obviously has more experience with the query process and with using coder speak as opposed to physician speak.
That's
and that's really
point.
Where we need to bring all the physicians is to using coder speak.
Right, and I think just a couple other key points as we wind down the podcast. I have sort of a pet peeve. I've been saying this for years. I've been in the CDI space even before it was called CDI back in 1994. Something that has not changed that I'm seeing even going in the wrong direction is that would help avoid or alleviate a lot of these unnecessarily costly clinical validation and medical necessity denials, is that we're spending too much time on the query process, and we're not spending or devoting enough energy to educating and sharing best practices of communication with the physician. So we're looking at the total picture, but we're not changing behavior. We're not improving the communication of the patient's story. Of course, as Michelle just mentioned, all we're getting is more denials. So I want to just go over one more concept or area for discussion. What steps, most importantly, now that we know what the payers are doing, what steps can CDI take to be a driving force in alleviating these denials and increasing ability to successfully appeal? So what things can we be doing to help drive down these costly denials and offer better opportunity for the payers, the providers, like you, and people involved in the denials and appeals process to be able to effectively construct an appeal? What are you thinking?
Well, as you've already said, rather than the query process, physician education is the key. Physician education really is the place where we can talk to physicians about being sure that what they're documenting paints a consistent clinical picture of the patient that they're seeing, and that it's not just about the diagnosis, but is the physical exam consistent? Have they looked at their physical exam template on that patient, and have they changed the things that they have seen in the patient that caused them to make their diagnosis away from just a normal physical exam? In the emergency department, if you have just a completely normal physical exam in the emergency department note, the question really is, doctor, why does this patient need an inpatient hospital exam if everything about them looks normal? If you have a patient where the physician has documented that they have severe malnutrition, but all of their physical exams say the patient is well-nourished,
yeah.
If the patient truly appears well-nourished, how do they have severe malnutrition? Maybe they don't really have severe malnutrition, but you're not painting a consistent picture of the patient, and you need to either look at your diagnosis or your physical description, because these two shouldn't be coexisting side by side in the same patient. And I think the place where we can really delve deeply into this conversation with mm-hmm. physicians is through our physician education. The query process is too limited of an interaction and too short and too specific to each patient to really start to explore some of these areas and how we can truly help our physicians, because we don't want to overburden them with CDI. We want to help them work smarter and do a better job with their documentation in fewer words to get to the point, create a good medical record, and move on.
Absolutely. And I just wanted to add a few key points before we close the podcast, because those are great points, excellent points, Michelle. One area that I believe CDI can certainly be a driving force is taken, I think, as a whole, not just individually, but as a profession, individually and collectively. And I'm calling on our associations, AHIMA and ACTIS, to take note. CDI has reached a plateau. It has value. It still has value. But we have not kept up with the changes in documentation requirements dictated by payers. Even for accountable care organizations and shared savings programs and upside and downside risk, we must take note of what CDI stands for. It's what facilitators and communication of patient care, and that means getting away primarily from the query process, as Michelle has said, and becoming more actively involved as coaches, as advocates, as facilitators working in partnership with physicians, because sending queries out and expecting the physicians to answer them, to me, is not really a partnership. It's a one-way-sided business relationship, and we really need to change our outlook of what CDI is. Any closing thoughts, Michelle, before we wrap this up?
I echo exactly what you're saying, and I appreciate you allowing me to come and share my thoughts today. And I look forward to CDI being more of a partner with the physicians in the future and coaching them, as opposed to the query and the physician groaning and going, oh, what do you want now?
That's right. Absolutely. So I really appreciate your time, Michelle, and thank you, everyone, for listening to the podcast. There's a whole litany of other podcasts available on the core-cdi.com website. And if you haven't checked out another avenue for, I think, coaching and best practices of documentation, you can also look at Top Gun Audit School. That's topgunauditschool.com, where we have some several upcoming webinars. We have one coming up tomorrow, which is the 5th. Is it tomorrow the 5th? Sure is. On the mechanics of chart review. It's going to be recorded in case you can't listen. So thank you very much, and good luck with CDI.